来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来来
последние листы с ногих своих ветвей. Дохнул осенний хлад, дорога промерзает, журчаще бежит за мельницей ручей, но пруд уже застыл. Сосед мой поспешает в отъезжие поля с охотой своей, и страж ждут озими от бешеной забавы, и будет лай собак, уснувший дубравы. Теперь моя пора. Я не люблю весны, скучна мне оттепель, вонь, грязь. Весной я болен, кровь бродит, чувства ум тоскою стеснены. Суровой зимой я более доволен, люблю ее снега, в присутствии луны, как легкий бег саней, с подругой быстр и волен, когда под соболем согрета и свежа, она вам руку жмет, пылая и дрожа. Как весело, обув железом острым ноги, скользить по зеркалу стоячих ровных рек, а зимних праздников блестящие тревоги. Но надо знать и честь. Полгода снег да снег, ведь это, наконец, и жителю берлоги медведю надоест. Нельзя же целый век кататься нам в санях с армидами молодыми или киснуть у печей за стеклами двойными. Ах, лето красное, любил бы я тебя, когда б не зной да пыль, да комары, да мухи, ты все душевные способности губя нас мучишь, как поля. Мы страждем от засухи, лишь как бы напоить да освежить себя. Иной в нас мысли нет, и жаль зимы старухи. И, проводив ее блинами и вином, поминки ей творим мороженым и льдом. Дни поздней осени бронят обыкновенно, но мне она мила, читатель дорогой, красою тихою, блистающей смиренно. Так нелюбимое дитя в семье родной к себе меня влечет. Сказать вам откровенно, из годовых времен я рад лишь ей одной. В ней много доброго, любовник нечиславный, я нечто в ней нашел мечтою своенравной. Как это объяснить? Мне нравится она, как, вероятно, вам чахоточное дело порой нравится. На смерть осуждена, бедняжка клонится, без ропота, без гнева, улыбка на устах увянувших видна. Могильной пропасти она не слышит дела, играет на лице еще багровый цвет. Она жива еще сегодня, завтра нет. Унылая пора очей очарования. Приятно мне твоя прощальная краса. Люблю я пышное природу видание, в багрец и в золото одетые леса, в их сенях ветра шумного и свежие дыхания, и мглой волнистую покрыты небеса, и редкий солнце луч, и первый мороз, и отдаленные седой зимы угрозы. И с каждой осенью я расцветаю вновь. Здоровью моему полезен русский холод. К привычкам бытия вновь чувствую любовь. Чередой слетает сон, чередой находит голод. Легко и радостно играет в сердце кровь. Желания кипят, я снова счастлив. Молод, я снова жизни полон. Таков мой организм. Извольте мне простить ненужный прозаизм. Ведут ко мне коня в раздоле открытом, махая гривой он всадника несет, и звонко под его блистающим копытом звенит промерзлый дол и трескается лед. Но гаснет краткий день, и в камельке забытом огонь опять горит, то яркий свет льет, то тлеет медленно. А я пред ним читаю, и думы долгие в душе моей питаю, и забываю мир. И в сладкой тишине я сладко усыплен моим воображением, и пробуждается поэзия во мне. Душа стесняется лирическим волнением, трепещет и звучит, и ищет, как во сне, и злится, наконец, свободным проявлением. И тут ко мне идет незримый рой гостей, знакомцы давние, плоды мечты моей. И мысли в голове волнуются в отваге, и рифмы легкие навстречу им бегут, и пальцы просятся к перу, перо к бумаге. Минута, и стихи свободно потекут, как дремлет недвижимый корабль в недвижной влаге. Мочу, матросы вдруг кидаются, ползут вверх, вниз, и паруса надулись.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. But what about the man who dreamt it all up? No millions for him. He simply wanted to give it away for the benefit of others.
Because it's open, anybody can think about how it could be better. So there's an incredible rate of development. There's an incredible rate of people bringing ideas to it. If it was the property of one company, my company or anybody else's company, it would have been a block. Anything which is centralized becomes a block. If you let the whole world tackle it in parallel, it goes incredibly fast.
Are you happy with the way it's developed?
Very.
The picture has changed quite a lot since then, and Sir Tim has more reservations about some of the things happening on the web, like the unprecedented spread of fake news, the targeting of vulnerable voters with misinformation, corporations selling our personal information for profit, and now we have the rise of AI, also made possible by the web, and who knows where that's going to take us. When Sir Tim came into our studio, we spoke about all of these things. We'll hear about his concerns and what he thinks we can all do to protect ourselves from the worst of the web. But he also talked very warmly about his childhood, his family, and encounters at the coffee bar at the research lab CERN, where his idea was born. So Tim Berners-Lee, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You made science fiction fact. So how come you're not a billionaire?
Well, it was really important that the web should be free for anybody to use. And that would mean it has to be free of charge. So I couldn't charge people 2 cents a click, as well as ask them. I want people to put everything on the web, but that was a big ask.
Right, and you had to persuade people that indeed this should not be for sale.
Yes, I worked for an organisation called CERN in Switzerland. And CERN could have, in principle, they could have decided that anything going on in the web should be taxable in some way, but with royalties at CERN. But we got from them a commitment eventually in 1993 that they wouldn't charge royalties.
Right, which is a remarkable gift that you have given to the world, actually. But interestingly enough as well, you haven't seemed to pursue fame any more than you pursued money. I just want to mention a couple of names, both men who were born in the same year as you, 1955, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, who also transformed our digital lives. Do you wish that you were as famous as them?
No, I don't. Life must be really, being famous must be a total pain.
And your family is very important to you?
Very.
You're married to Rosemary. You have 5 children in
between
your family,
us, yeah.
Between you.
Mm.
Do they treat you as a public figure? Do they see you as a public figure?
Not so, no. You know, we've always had rules from when Alice and Ben were in school. We always had a rule that school should never talk about me and the web. And so they're in primary school, you know, all the teachers knew. There was one time when the headmistress came into Alice's class with a Time magazine, said, "Hey, Alice, is your dad on the front of Time magazine?" And she said, "What?" She said, "Is this your dad?" "Yeah, that's my dad." "What does he do at work?" "He talks to people." Meanwhile, the teacher was saying, "No, stop." Headmistress had forgotten. And the rule, and so we had a rule that just my family would not talk about in school.
Right.
And now they're all big and old and wise. They're well past being fazed by fame.
Yeah. So you don't like the limelight much?
No, not that much.
No. This will make you, I think, in the modern era, a very curious sort of person, somebody who is not gone after fame and money. And I would really like to understand where that's come from. And I suppose the obvious place to start with that is your parents. A pretty extraordinary pair, by all
yes.
accounts.
Mum and Dad. Yeah. Mum and Dad met building the very first computer in the UK. And so, of course, that was a huge thing. And they were part of a team at Ferranti. And so that group of people, they were thinking about what is a computer anyway? What does it mean to be a computer, to have a computer? They were wondering about, could a computer be intelligent? What would that mean?
So these were discussions in your childhood home about what a computer could do.
Well, Dad wrote the speeches for Basil DeFranti. Basil DeFranti was the head of the Franti, and his speeches had to come from somewhere, and Dad was one of the people who writing speeches for him. And so they had to spend a lot of time explaining to people what a computer was and talking about things like ones and zeros. It worked with ones and zeros. It worked with binaries. He had to do things. He had to think the examples with halflings and farthings, which back then were binary coins that we had. And so, and he made a computer out of, made a little computer out of water jets, so that when two water jets went on at the same time, they would make go into a particular pot and go on that through the system. So
he made this at home?
He made it at home, yeah.
Did you help him?
Yeah, well, I admire the result, certainly. he did that because then you could see that computing was just logic. It's just, if this comes on, then this comes on.
I know your parents were, of course, very logical, very rational people, given what they did. Mm-hmm. There's a fantastic story about your mum, Mary Lee, who's a real pioneer. But she, I think, was quite a devoted churchgoer. But she believed that all churches should have a notice on the door saying, take everything within metaphorically.
Yep, that's right.
So very rational people, but...
Rather rational, but yes, mum was quite devout, but also very scientific.
Mm-hmm. And very creative and very imaginative. And I think you're the first of four children. She paused her career when she had you. And what was her motherly style? What was her approach to you?
Mostly letting us get on with it. So watchful negligence, she called it.
Watchful negligence.
So we were within walking distance of Richmond Park, so that was a wonderful playground. We made a go-kart out of an old pram with old pram wheels at the back and pushchair wheels at the front, and then we'd push that around all over the park.
And in the home, making train sets?
I eventually got really into trains. Partly I went to Emmanuel School, which is right between train tracks in London, so that once, if you go to, anybody who goes to Emmanuel, you're forced to look at trains because they go by right by the school. And so that was, so eventually I enjoyed making train sets. And when we converted the loft into two rooms, my request was mine should be as long as possible. So my brother's room was about square, but mine was long and thin because that's what you need for a train set.
Right, okay. How would you describe yourself as a boy?
As a boy, I was introverted, shy. So I went to an all-boys school, so that growing up I never had a girlfriend. While I was in high school, I never really went to dances and things, so I guess the energy went into mathematics and physics, mm-hmm. and electronics, so right. Building things. That's things I did with my friend, was building electronics.
Right. What was the focus of the family home?
I suppose, Mum was the driving force, I suppose. So she, Dad would go to work, and he was very, very involved with us as growing up. But Mum was the driving force. Mum organised everything. Mum organised that we went camping, for example. She'd enjoyed camping when she'd been when she'd gone to Australia early on in her career. And so she found that being in a tent on the ground, knowing that's all you've got, is very, she did that in Australia, and we did that then later as a family. So we'd all go camping together. We'd go and stay in a friend's orchard, or we'd go and stay at a sort of National Trust campsite or something. And then we'd... So we all knew that all we needed was a tent. And I think that's a very strong... gives you a strong feeling of self-sufficiency for the rest of life.
That's interesting. So I wonder if that ties into what we touched on earlier, which is that you're not that interested in money and things. Do you think that comes from your parents?
Well, I was also remember the tradition. When I invented the web, the internet had already been invented 20 years beforehand. So I was building on the shoulders of these giants who made the internet, so Vint Cerf and colleagues. And I was building on that, and all that was free. The internet was there to spread as an idea, but the really important thing was there should be only one web, and sort of keeping it free
so
was important.
If the internet is the sort of infrastructure, if that's the way that computers talk to each other, how does the web then relate to the internet in the simplest terms?
So the web is everything. When you click on something, click on a link, that's the web. So when you type in something that starts HTTP, that's the web. None of that. Clicking on one thing and going to another thing somewhere in the world, didn't exist before I invented it.
Right. Let's talk about how you invented this. So you went to university, you read physics, you go and get various jobs in the computer field, largely. You go to CERN, you mentioned CERN. This is this very well-respected, very international scientific research centre in Switzerland. And this is where you dream up this idea of the World Wide Web. What was the problem that you were trying to fix?
The problem I was trying to fix was that people from CERN come from all over the world. And when they come from all over the world, they bring with them different sorts of computer and different sorts of computer system and different sorts of documentation system. So all of those were incompatible systems. And so if you wanted to find out about how did that module connect to another person's module, then in practice what you needed to do, you'd find that person and you'd go and give them a coffee.
Right.
So the coffee space was really important. The coffee space was at the intersection of the different corridors. And so if you needed somebody else, you could wait till they walked by and pick them up. Mm-hmm. So in a way, shouldn't the web be something which could provide that functionality?
The world's coffee shop, basically.
The world's coffee shop, yeah.
So I said that you dreamt up the World Wide Web, and I don't really know if that's what you did. When you see a problem, when you identify a problem and you're trying to think about a solution, do you code the solution primarily, or are you also having a vision? Is this also an act of imagination?
Both. When you code something up, supposing you're imagining an app, you imagine how the app would be, and you sit down with your computer, and you type, and you have in your mind's eye, you have what the app is going to look like, and that all turns into code. There's code for each box. In fact, when I designed the web, in fact, I had a drag and drop system that I could design the app with. So basically, when you're just writing an app by yourself, then you have the requirements in your head and the design in your head and then you code.
You're designing it, you're coding it, and you talk about designing apps, but this was the first app. This was entirely new.
This was the first web browser.
So how do you go about persuading other people to buy into what is in your head at that point, which is a vision that you have got? I imagine it's a little bit like trying to describe to somebody a colour that is not yet in existence. How do you do that?
It is a bit like that. It's called a paradigm shift. A paradigm shift is when the words for describing the new system don't exist in the old world. So now we talk about clicking, how it's three clicks away, and people know what that means. But the idea that you would click and go to somewhere, anywhere in the world before, was people just could not imagine it. And dealing with that lack of imagination was really hard. I'd find that I'd give a talk, maybe to 100 people, and you'd notice three people would prick their ears up, for example, and come back and find me afterwards. And they'd get it, so a few people would. But I didn't need the whole world to start using the web once. I needed a few people.
And initially, you needed somebody to buy into the idea in the first place and to give you the freedom to work on it. And so I know you wrote to your boss, you've sent your plan, and you found out much later that the notes he'd written on it were vague but exciting. Which is a fabulous description. But it took a while to get the go-ahead to say, go on, have a go, yes, see what you can come up with.
Well, Mike Sandel, in fact, the person I gave the memo to, he was diagnosed with cancer at that point. So he had much bigger things going on in his life. But he did tell me to just go ahead. He said, buy a next machine, because you've always wanted to buy one of those next boxes, which was made by Steve Jobs when he left Apple. And the next computer had really powerful tools for developing apps. So buy the next computer and use it to make some app. And so why don't you do that World Wide Web thing you've been talking about?
That was a lucky break, I think, for the world. Mm. So you then turn this around in a matter of months, get it ready for launch? I mean, unbelievably fast.
Well, 3 months it took. I had to get it ready for Christmas because we had a baby. Our first baby was due on December 24th, in fact. And anyway, CERN closed to save energy. CERN closed in the middle of December. So I started working on September. I had to get the app basically released by the end of the year.
So this is while your wife is 8-9 months pregnant.
Yep.
You're working on this.
Yep. And then Alice was born then on the 1st of January, in fact. She was late. But that year was all about Alice. It wasn't about the web.
Oh, how interesting, because you'd launched these two sort of babies into the world at once. But the real baby took priority.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. When you published the first web page, a description, I think, of what the web was, which is still available, actually, to see online. What did that moment feel like? Did you think something big is about to happen?
There was never that sort of, this is the moment when is this everything happening, because it started off as being almost empty web page, and then I filled it in a bit. And then steadily the number of people who were looking at that web page went up by a factor of, in fact, it doubled every 4 months. So, in fact, so that doubled every 4 months for the first 3 years. So, the number of people using that first web server, the number of hits we had per day, went up at absolute rock solid exponential.
Did you see what this could become? Did you think this is going to change the way we live?
Well, I wanted everything on the web. And I designed it to be universal. So that was, there were lots of systems I'd seen designed which weren't universal, which had some constraint about the document you made. You had to put it on a particular sort of computer or something. But the web had to be unconstrained, it had to be universal.
When you say you wanted everything on the web, you mean everything on the web?
I meant anything originally, but now we've got more or less everything.
Right, okay. You were telling us about your parents, their values, their attitudes. When you were thinking about the web and bringing those values with you, were you thinking just about the good stuff that could happen there, the shared creativity, the exchange of ideas, you know, the easing of problems, the shared finding of solutions? Is that what you were thinking about?
Well, initially, I took the three previous people who'd made a consortium, so there would be just one system. And their motto was that technology was neutral. So, you know, they said, good people can use it, bad people can use it, but the technology itself is fundamentally, they thought, neutral. And I went along with that for a bit. So when people say, but what about the bad things? Well, they're, you know, fraud is illegal on the web or off the web, so the web didn't change that. So until 2016, really, I felt that technology was neutral.
And then
2016, the Trump elections and the Brexit election, and then people said maybe the web had been used to manipulate people to vote for something that was not in their best interests. And maybe the web technology itself was polarizing. So in other words, maybe, whereas the web itself might be neutral, maybe Snapchat isn't, maybe TikTok isn't, maybe Instagram isn't.
How did that make you feel?
Big double take. It made me very concerned that we should perhaps limit the extent to which people make their websites addictive, for example.
Okay.
Technology isn't always neutral. There's a social side when you design a technology. When you design something like Snapchat or something which is addictive, then you deliberately make it addictive. When you design something like Pinterest, I haven't heard of people getting addicted to Pinterest, but in both cases, people use Instagram or they use Pinterest. One of them is designed to be addictive, the other one isn't. People spend a lot more time on Instagram because they get stuck on it. But they can use Pinterest to share photos as well.
So what makes something addictive?
It's very deliberately the way you connect the AI algorithm to the system. You train the AI, then you choose what it is you give rewards to. You choose whether you reward it for keeping somebody on the platform, even though that might be making them angry, for example.
Because that increases engagement.
Yeah. So it's the way that the algorithm has been trained. If it's trained to polarize people, then that's not a neutral piece of technology. That's a piece of technology which is making the world a worse place.
After the break, the inventor of the World Wide Web, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, on how we can all make the web safer for ourselves. We'll also put a question to him asked by an AI, which wants to know how he feels about having made its existence possible. This is Outlook, online at bbcworldservice.com/outlook and reachable on WhatsApp. Our number, +44 330 678 2707.
This is the BBC World Service, where our new series, Cyberhack, Evil Core,